drawn out of range, tried to maneuver his way around the defenders instead. His new course was headed directly for the warp point, as if he thought he could blast his way through the waiting super-dreadnoughts and battlecruisers. But he was wrong. Comm lasers whispered across the gulf between the fleet's separated battle lines, and the second component slowed. It would move just past the warp point, maneuvering to stay between the enemy and his only way home, and wait until its fellows drove him into its tentacles. Anson Oliveira gathered his battered strike groups astern of the carriers. He didn't know exactly what Admiral Murakuma planned, and the thought of leading his pilots into that much firepower turned his belly to lead. But he knew she had no choice, and his earlier thoughts about expendability jeered at him. If the destruction of every fighter got even a single division of super-dreadnoughts out of the trap, the exchange would be completely worthwhile, which wasn't much comfort for the human and Ophiuchi pilots about to sacrifice themselves. The pursuing bugs swept past the warp point and slowed. They came to a halt, backs to the warp point, targeting systems, tracking his fighters, and he swallowed. He sat tense and still, waiting for the order, and a corner of his brain noted the courier drones flashing past him.
"Fang Anasa!"
Anasa looked up at his comm officer's shout.
"The drones!"
the officer said sharply, and Anasa bared his fangs.
"Go!"
Oliveira's command crackled over the net, and 200 fighters streaked straight down the bug's throat. Every one of those pilots knew, didn't think, knew. He or she was going to die. But they were doomed anyway, and they rammed their power through the emergency gate, for if they had to die, at least they could kill a few more enemies first. Oliveira's vision grayed as Malachi took them in at a velocity so far beyond design limits he couldn't believe the bird was holding together, and he bared his teeth. Then jerked in surprise, despite the crushing power of the drive, at Carl Hathaway's shriek of delight.
"Beautiful! Ah, beautiful!"
the TAC officer screamed.
"Look at him, Skip! Look at those fucking tabbies go!"
One moment, the second arachnid force had the situation completely under control. The next, an insane explosion of violence ripped into it as TF-53, the Orion task force the bugs had never seen, never suspected had been held back, flashed through the warp point into its rear. No one in the galaxy was better at fighter ops than the Khan, and Fang Anasa's deck crew set an all-new Navy record for launch speeds. 210 fresh fighters charged straight up the bugs' blind spots as their missiles had charged up TF-52s. And they weren't alone, for the SBM Hawks Murakuma hadn't used in her initial bombardment came with them. There'd been no need to use them to kill a mere 50 cruisers. Now 70 fresh pods belched missiles into the astonished bugs, and the fires screamed in behind them, ripples salvoing their frams. It was the most devastating fighter strike in history. 20 bug super-dreadnoughts were blown apart in 60 shrieking seconds, and 18 battlecruisers went with them. Almost every surviving ship was damaged, many badly, and the tabby pilots closed in, accepting brutal losses from the survivors' point defense to strafe with their onboard lasers. Less than 40 seconds later, Anson Oliveira's fighters came howling in from dead ahead, taking their own losses but slamming a fresh wave of frams down the bugs' throats. The twin strike couldn't kill them all, but it hurt them, and the ships which had lured Murakuma into pursuing them had fallen too far astern of TF-51 to help them. Demosthenes Waldeck's battle line flashed past TF-52's wounded carriers, and Rendova's ships reefed around in the hairpin turns of inertia-canceling drives to follow in their wake. But it was up to the heavies to clear the way, and Waldeck and Vanessa Murakuma took them straight into the bug's teeth, as though super-dreadnoughts were so many fighters. It was insane, a violation of every manual ever written, and the only path to salvation. Every one of Anasa's carriers and battlecruisers was within the bug's weapons envelope. If TF-51 didn't close, they would be annihilated, despite the shocking damage they'd inflicted, and Murakuma had to break through before the bugs pursuing her could overhaul. The enemy knew it, too, and detached his faster cruiser in a desperate bid to assist their fellows on the warp point. But the cruisers had to get past TF-52, and Rendova launched her surviving escorts into them in a savage, short-ranged hammering match that kept them off Waldeck's back, at a price. Yet furious as that fight was, it was a sideshow, and Murakuma sealed her helmet as TF-51 slammed into the bugs. Launchers went to sprint mode, spitting standard missiles and the heavier, far more destructive CM-sized close assault missiles. Answering fire smashed back, and Cobra heaved as fists of flame hammered her shields flat. Force beams, primaries, plasma guns, het lasers, and Ophiuchi particle beams snarled at ranges as low as 800 kilometers, and armor ripped like tissue. Damage alarms screamed. Two of her super dreadnoughts blew apart. A bug battlecruiser rammed a Terran battleship head-on. Two more battleships vanished in massive fireballs, and then something smashed into Cobra like the hammer of Thor. She felt her flagship heave, heard the scream of escaping air, saw Ling Tian torn in half by a flying axe that was once a bulkhead, and then something exploded into the side of her own command chair, and her universe vanished in an instant of agony too terrible to endure. The last bug super dreadnought blew up under the fire of 3 Terran super dreadnoughts and 60 fighters, and TF-51 survivors turned at bay. They faced the remaining enemy force, holding it off until the last damaged carrier made transit. Of the 500 fighters which had actually launched, 206 escaped aboard Anasa's carriers, and the only 3 unhurt Terran CVs, and then the rear guard retreated to Sarasota, still smashing sullenly at its foes. 8 super dreadnoughts, 7 battleships, 14 battle cruisers, 11 carriers, 5 heavy cruisers, and 18 light cruisers remained behind forever.
Marcus?
Vanessa Murakuma didn't recognize her own hoarse whisper, but Marcus LeBlanc bent over her instantly. She lay under crisp sheets, staring up at a pastel overhead, and she could feel nothing from the waist down.
Hi,
LeBlanc said softly.
Tian,
she whispered, and he flinched. Then he shook his head gently, and she turned away in agony. Her tears blotted the pillow, but LeBlanc's gentle fingers cupped her chin, making her turn back to him.
You got them out, Vanessa,
he said quietly.
But how many?
Her voice was stark and wounded, her green eyes dark, bottomless wells of pain, and he blinked his own eyes as tears stung.
More than anyone else could have, he said.
Her mouth twisted, and he bent lower over her.
Damn it, Vanessa, it's true. All right, they suckered you. Well, they suckered me, Waldeck, Teller, Anasa, even Tian. No one could have seen that coming, and no one else could have gotten us out of it. Don't you dare think otherwise,
or what?
She expected it to come out with savage bitterness, but to her astonishment it came out soft, almost chiding.
Or as soon as you're out of that bed, sir, I'll put you over my knee, peel down those trousers, and wail the living shit out of you,
he told her fiercely, and a soft ghost of a laugh gurgled in her throat. Her eyes softened, and she raised an arm which felt far heavier than even a full standard gravity could account for, to touch the side of his face.
Oh, Marcus, she whispered, I should have listened to you, love.
Why, you thought I was arguing just because I was worried about you. And I was, he admitted. He sank into a chair and caught her hand as it started to fall, cradling it against his cheek.
I guess maybe that's why regs frown on people who love each other in the same chain of command, isn't it?
He said gently.
Maybe, but you were still right.
It's my job to be right, and I sometimes manage it. But it's your job to win battles, not take counsel of your fears, or mine. He smiled and stroked red hair back from her forehead.
How bad is it?
She asked after a moment, gesturing at her lower body with her free hand, and he smiled again.
It looks terrible, he said frankly, but the doctors are delighted with themselves, and they say you should be up and around again within 6 or 7 weeks. You'll have to take it easy for quite a while, but you're going to be fine, Vanessa, really.
Well, at least I'll have time to take it easy, she said with a trace of bitterness, and he raised an eyebrow. Come on, Marcus. You know they're going to relieve me after this fuck-up.
You have a strange way of describing a battle in which you kicked the bad guy's ass, Admiral Murakuma,
LeBlanc said, and she snorted her opinion of his judgment.
No, I mean it. The bugs lost 139 ships. That's a better than 2-to-1 ratio in hulls, and the tonnage balance was even more decisive. Sky Marshal Avram is very pleased with you, and she's going to be even more pleased when she hears what happened yesterday.
Yesterday, Murakuma repeated blankly, and he nodded.
The bugs tried to bounce Sarasota. I guess they figured they'd hurt us badly enough to make it easy, and they brought up reinforcements. But Demosthenes and Leroy, and Lord, how I wish you'd seen that pair working together, got reorganized with Anasa and put Leonidas II into operation, exactly as you'd planned. They lost every cruiser and the first 25 SDs that tried to follow. His eyes blazed, and he stroked more hair from her forehead. They broke off, Vanessa. You finally stopped the bastards so cold they knew they were licked.
You mean Demosthenes did, she whispered, but her own eyes glowed, and LeBlanc shook his head.
Woman, you aren't allowed any more doubts.
After all, he grinned wickedly,
that's why I'm here, right?
She laughed again softly, and he bent still closer and kissed her.
Chapter 18. Welcome along, sir. The powered walker whined softly as Vanessa Murakuma walked from the intraship car into the boat bay. The muscle-feedback-controlled walker was less responsive than the direct neural-feed prosthetics used to replace lost limbs, which made her progress more than a little clumsy. But she wasn't complaining. She didn't want permanent replacement parts, however efficient, and the surgeons promised her legs would be as good as new in time. They were talking about 6 months, though she intended to make it in 4, and this wasn't even the first time she'd had to use a walker, for her homeworld prepared its people poorly for the planets most humans lived on. She'd spent 3 years exercising her Truman-bred muscles before reporting to the Academy, but New Annapolis's 1.25 gravities had still been a hideous ordeal. The medical staff had insisted she stick with the walker for her first semester, and the aching cramps protesting a body weight 60% greater than the one she'd been bred to had made her perfectly willing to obey. Now she maneuvered herself into position in TFNS Euphrates Boat Bay and tried to suppress a pang of grief for her last flagship as another cutter docked. Cobra had been luckier than many of Fifth Fleet's ships, but she'd still taken a fearsome pounding. She'd only returned to service last week, and 2/3 of her tactical department were squeaky new replacements for men and women who'd died in Justin. Murakuma no longer had a logical reason to oppose shifting her lights to one of the better-protected Mekong-class SDs, and she admitted she no longer wanted to, seeing all those new faces in place of the ones she'd come to know so well. She shook off the thought as a hatch opened and the side parties, 2 separate honor guards, one of Terran Marines, gorgeous in black and green dress uniform, and a second of even more gorgeously bejeweled Orion Marines, snapped to attention. The first person through the hatch was a human. He was a little more than average height for his race, but despite the snow-white hair and beard, he radiated a sense of purposeful mass which made him seem much bigger. His Orion companion's night-black pelt was liberally threaded with silver, yet the tabby carried himself with a springy predator's grace, only slightly stiffened by age. No one, however, would have described the human as graceful. He certainly wasn't clumsy, but he moved with a burly, unstoppable momentum which dared any object to intrude into his path, and promised no quarter for anything foolish enough to accept the challenge. "Grand Fleet arriving," the intercom announced through the twitter of the bosun's pipes, and Euphrates' captain nodded to the side party. "Present arms!" The barked command was in standard English, since Euphrates was a human ship, but both Marine contingents snapped to their version of present arms with the simultaneous precision of careful practice. A corner of Murakuma's eye noted the perfection of the maneuver, yet her attention was focused on the 2 visitors as they saluted the Federation banner on the boat bay's forward bulkhead, then turned to salute Captain Decker as well.
"Permission to come aboard, sir?"
"Permission granted, sir," Jessica Decker said.
The visitors crossed the line on the deck, formally boarding the ship, and Murakuma's walker whined as she stepped forward and saluted.
"Admiral Antonov, Fank Thara, welcome to Fifth Fleet."
"Thank you, Admiral Murakuma."
Antonov's deep bass rumble hadn't gotten any frailer since his retirement,
She'd met him several times during her stint as a War College instructor, and she felt a bit odd addressing him as Admiral, since he'd been Sky Marshal at the time.
"It's good to see you again," Antonov went on, and waved a hand at the tall tabby. "I don't believe you've met Lord Talfon."
"No, sir."
Murakuma turned to the Orion with a polite, tooth-hidden smile of greeting. "Ninth Fang of the Khan Kharazartan, Lord Talfon and Kanakahaur Zartan, had been a pilot's pilot in a service where the fighter reigned supreme. He was also the ninth-ranking active-duty officer in the Khan service, and almost as legendary in TFN service as well as the Khan, as Antonov himself, and Murakuma's small Orion-style bow of greeting was deeply respectful.
"I've certainly heard a great deal about you, however, sir. I'm honored to meet you at last, and my carrier pilots have asked me to extend their invitation to a small party aboard Orca. I believe they want to offer you an, traditional welcome to the fleet."
The big tabby's whiskers twitched as he gave her a small, answering bow of acceptance.
"I would be honored, Admiral," he yowled as her earbug translated. "Although a warrior of my advanced years may find it somewhat difficult to do full justice to their invitation."
"Ha!" Antonov snorted derisively. "No doubt they'll offer you bourbon or some other anemic substitute."
"No, sir," Murakuma murmured. "Least Fang Anasa has informed us Lord Talfon prefers vodka, and I understand a suitable supply has been laid in."
"Korosho! Good! Perhaps we'll civilize our flight crews yet."
"We'll certainly try, sir,"
Murakuma agreed, then waved towards the intraship car.
"In the meantime, I've asked the fleet senior officers to assemble in briefing room 3. If you and Fang Thara would care to accompany me?"
"Of course, Admiral." Antonov nodded briskly to the side party and honor guards, and he and Kathara adjusted their pace to that of Murakuma's walker as they crossed to the waiting car. Murakuma steered the walker into her cabin and allowed herself to sigh with relief as the hatch closed behind her. She worked her way behind her desk, maneuvering carefully in quarters designed for people with two good legs, and parked at her terminal. That was the only word for it. Handy as her artificial suspension was, it was a pain to climb in and out of, but at least, she reminded herself with a weary grin as she brought up Fifth Fleet's current order of battle, it was also the right height to let her work at her desk without a chair.
"Just as well, too, the way paperwork keeps piling up. I'll be stuck here for hours. Don't think I'll complain, though. The problems I've got now beat the crap out of the ones I had 2 months ago."
She studied the order of battle with deeply grateful satisfaction, for despite the reaming her command had taken in Third Justin, she was stronger than ever before, and the trickle of reinforcements flowing down through the Romulus cluster was about to become a torrent.
"We did it," she thought almost wonderingly. "We actually did it. We held the bastards long enough for the Alliance to get organized. And now,"
her face turned suddenly grimmer,
"it's time to turn this thing around and kick their asses the hell out of Justin."
She ran her eyes down the OB. Additional units had come up from every Allied navy. Terran, Ophiuchi, Orion, even the first Gorm ships. She was particularly glad to see the latter, for the high tactical speed of Gorm starships made them especially valuable. More to the point, perhaps, the GSN had the furthest to come to reach Sarasota, and the arrival of its first units had been an enormous shot in the arm for Fifth Fleet's morale. Not that their contribution was solely symbolic. Fifth Fleet now counted over 120 starships, headed by 81 capital ships, including 6 GSN super dreadnoughts and 5 GSN battle cruisers, and supported by 19 fleet and 8 light carriers. Its Task Force 54, commanded by the newly promoted Rear Admiral Reichman since his return to active duty, consisted of 29 massive fortresses, with almost 800 fighters embarked, and still more forts were under construction. Fifth Fleet's mobile units could put over 900 more fighters, almost half of them Orion, into space, and for the first time, Vanessa Murakuma was absolutely confident of her ability to stop any bug offensive cold.
"But the point isn't to stop them," she reminded herself, green eyes momentarily bleak.
She studied the numbers a moment longer, then punched a combination into her comm panel, and the screen lit almost instantly with the face of a painfully young female lieutenant. "Intelligence Lieutenant Abernathy," the young woman announced, then stiffened to a sort of seated attention as she recognized Fifth Fleet CO.
"How can I help you, Admiral?"
"Is Commodore LeBlanc there?"
"No, sir. He's in CIC.
Would you ask him to join me in my quarters? I'd like to see Captain McKenna and Commander Cruchero, too. Please run them down for me and ask him to accompany him."
"Of course, sir."
"Thank you." Murakuma cut the circuit and leaned back. Antonov's decision to inspect the front meant he and Lord Talfon would be looking over her shoulder, but both of them had earned reputations as aggressive, hard-hitting COs in the Theban War, and nothing indicated they'd changed since. She was confident she could convince them to authorize the operation. Assuming she could convince her own staff, she hadn't lost her mind.
"You want to do what?"
LeBlanc hadn't raised his voice. In fact, he sounded more resigned than incredulous, and McKenna simply sat back in his chair with a sigh. Commander Ernesto Cruchero, Ling Tian's replacement as Murakuma's ops officer, was another matter. His hawk-nosed, dark face was well-suited to concealing strong emotion, yet he couldn't quite hide his shock. He looked back and forth between his seniors for a moment, then cleared his throat.
"Excuse me, sir," he said diffidently, "but we don't know a thing about what the bugs are doing on the other side of the warp point, and we do know at least one of their major systems is far closer to Justin than we are to our own core systems. Given the fleets they've thrown at us so far, don't we have to assume they must have reinforced at least as strongly as we have?"
"Certainly," Murakuma agreed, and smiled thinly at the commander's expression. "I understand your point, Ernesto, but the transit times for our reinforcements, and theirs, aren't going to change. If we decide we can't risk action as long as they can reinforce faster than we can, we'll never take the offensive at all."
"No doubt, sir," McKenna put in, "but our first responsibility has to be keeping them out of Sarasota, not battering ourselves against their defenses."
"Agreed," Murakuma nodded, but there was no give in her expression.
"That's why we have TF-54 and the minefields covering the warp point. The purpose of fixed defenses, however, is to free up mobile forces, not anchor them in place. With Admiral Reichman to mind the store, we can afford to take some chances with our striking force. And I remind you all that there are still Terran civilians trapped in Justin. If our first responsibility is to protect Sarasota, surely our next highest obligation is to save as many Justinians as we can."
McKenna and Cruchera glanced at each other. There was no possible counter for that argument, but clearly they both remembered Fifth Fleet's last venture into Justin. Murakuma watched them for a moment, then looked at LeBlanc.
"Marcus?"
Her tone was neutral, but she held his eyes, and after a moment, he shrugged.
"Leroy and Ernesto both have valid points, but so do you. And while I agree that they've probably reinforced even more heavily than us, there's an element no one else has mentioned." He sounded like a man who didn't like the point he was about to make, but he made it unflinchingly. "We may have the technological edge, but we've already seen how quickly these things put both second-generation antimatter warheads and SBMs into production. Since they had neither when they started shooting 10 months ago, the fact that they have them now indicates their R&D is quick off the mark."
"Which," he looked at Cruchero,
"means that the longer we wait, the more chance there is of losing our current advantages. And that would put pressure on us to hit them as quickly as possible, even if they were only in a position to match the tonnage we can deploy."
"So you think we should attack?" Murakuma pressed.
"No, I only think we have to," he said unhappily.
There was a moment of silence, and then McKenna twitched his shoulders.
"Marcus is right, sir," he said flatly. "I shouldn't have let myself overlook that aspect."
"But even if they do duplicate our systems, they still have to put them into production."
Cruchero's tone was respectful but persistent, and Murakuma noted it with approval. She didn't know him well yet. McKenna had selected him while she was still in hospital, but he'd already demonstrated his competence, and it took courage for a commander to argue against the united opinion of an admiral, a commodore, and a captain. That was good. The last thing she wanted was an ops officer who rolled over and played dead.
"Maybe so," McKenna said now, "but we can't afford to mirror image them. We know how long it takes us to introduce new hardware, but they may be faster. Worse, we don't know how far their R&D has to go, and we won't know they've closed the gap on us, if they do, until they get around to using any new systems against us. That means we have to hit them as hard as we can while we do hold the edge. And as the Admiral says, we've got an obligation to take Justin back while at least some of its people are still alive.
Cruchero sat back, eyes hooded, then nodded, and Murakuma hid a sigh of relief. They'd come around more quickly than she'd expected, and she suddenly wondered why she thought they wouldn't. Was it a leftover from the terrible pressures of her retreat to Sarasota? Or was it because she knew how dreadfully Fifth Fleet could get hurt in Justin? Had she been projecting her own inner doubts onto her staffers? She shook the thought aside and leaned towards them.
All right, then. Marcus, I want you and Leroy to bring our appreciations and projections up to date. I know they're all tentative, but they're all we've got to work from. Once you've got that, I want the four of us to work out several rough ops plans. I don't need a lot of detail yet, but I want something tangible in hand before I sit down with the Allied COs. I don't expect anyone to question the necessity of the operation. I only want a clear, definite basis for discussion.
With your task force commanders or with Admiral Antonov? LeBlanc asked with a slight smile, and Murakuma looked at him innocently.
Why, Marcus, what makes you think I'm concerned about the Admiral's presence in our midst?
Her subordinates chuckled, and she smiled back.
All right, gentlemen, go put it together. I want your preliminary efforts on my terminal by 0900 tomorrow morning.
A most audacious plan, Admiral Murakuma.
Ivan Antonov's deep voice was thoughtful as he gazed at the hollow above the conference table. Ernesto Cruchero may have had his doubts about Operation Navarino, but the half-dozen alternative ops plans he'd put together were impressively aggressive and made maximum use of the Alliance's tactical advantages. Now Antonov studied the display, conscious of the eyes watching him with carefully hidden tension, and of the youth behind those eyes. Even Murakuma was less than half his age, and the near veneration of her younger staffers made him uncomfortable. That unquestioning sense of awaiting the Oracle's response was one of the reasons he'd retired in the first place. The anti-Geron treatments, unlike flashy gadgetry such as reactionless drives and faster-than-light travel, had changed the human condition in a fundamental way. The first such change since convenient contraception had broken the immemorial link between reproduction and sexual jollies. Now, a species selected by evolution to get out of the way of its adult children had the dubious blessing of living fossils like himself, as though Blackjack Pershing had lived on to command Operation Desert Storm. On the other hand, he reminded himself, perhaps a Pershing who'd kept himself technologically current wouldn't have been such a bad thing. At least he'd have had the experience to know what happens when you call a campaign off early. He shook the thought aside and used a light pencil to highlight the transport echelon which the hollow showed following in the wake of Fifth Fleet's warships.
"I don't recall GHQ's having provided you this many Marines, however," he rumbled mildly. "According to this, you're planning on using a full corps, just over 3 divisions.
"We are," Murakuma agreed, and nodded to McKenna.
"We've checked the numbers, Admiral Antonov," he said confidently, "and we can make them up if we strip the fleet base, comb out all our shipboard marine detachments, and combine Terran and Orion marines in composite regiments. We'll have some problems with equipment and doctrine compatibility, but General Mondesi and Least Claw Tharan believe they can overcome the difficulties if we give them a couple of weeks."
"I see."
Antonov glanced at his Vilkshatha brother, and Kathara gave a small ear flick of agreement. The Admiral returned his eyes to the hollow, his face giving no hint of the thoughts behind it, and sat in silence for another endless 90 seconds, then nodded slightly.
"Your plan seems sound, given what you know, Admiral Murakuma," he said slowly. "The problem, of course, is what you don't know, and omniscience is possible only for the Almighty. You have sufficient SBM hawks for the break-in."
"We believe so, sir. Fanganasa's fleet train is bringing forward Orion pods in some numbers. They won't link with ours, but we intend to split the targeting assignments. Our birds will go for one type of unit, probably the heavy cruisers, if they've deployed as before, and the Orions will go for any super dreadnoughts sufficiently close to the warp point."
"And if there are no capital ships?"
"Then we'll simply have to send them through in 2 waves and hit them with successive salvos. Or if we have sufficient TFN pods, we can hold the Orion SBM Hawks in reserve to cover our retreat in the event we're pushed back."
"I see,"
Antonov cocked his chair back, still gazing at the hollow, then shrugged.
Fifth Fleet is your command, Admiral. I never enjoyed having some rear echelon gas bag second-guess me.
Kathara gave a deep, purring chuckle, which Antonov ignored.
So I suppose I should grant you the same freedom I enjoyed.
Then you approve the operation, sir.
Fifth Fleet is your command, Antonov repeated, and you enjoy my fullest confidence. I would appreciate the chance to review your final ops plan, but yes, I approve the operation.
He smiled suddenly.
I only wish I could see the politicians when they hear about it.
I knew we would hear about politicians eventually, Vanya,
Kathara laughed.
Ha! If you'd had to put up with all the officious shit I've had to endure, you'd have a more respectful attitude, Kathara Kornazovich,
Antonov shot back.
Do you remember how the Pisti were all shitting their pants before Parsifal?
Those were the days, were they not?
The big tabby yowled regretfully.
But we were younger then, and you were a zagat with a broken tooth.
And you weren't, Antonov snorted, then shook his head. But you're right, we've grown too old. At last I truly understand how Howard Anderson must have felt.
He looked at Murakuma, and his deep voice was soft.
Remember this moment, Admiral. The most horrible lesson a commander ever learns is that people die following his orders. However good he is, however carefully he plans, however brilliantly he leads them, they die. I realize you've already learned that, yet at least you have this much. You risk your own life with them. You have not yet come to the point at which you must send them to their deaths from safety.
It was as if he and she were alone in the briefing room, and Vanessa Murakuma stared into the eyes of a legend, of the man still known as Ivan the Terrible, who'd fed his ships into the meat grinders of Parsifal, the Fourth Battle of Lorelei, and the Battle of Thebes without a tremor. There was pain in those eyes, and a grief utterly at odds with the ruthless image of the legend, and she felt strangely moved that he would lift his mask, however briefly, to share it with her. To tell her, she suddenly realized that she was not alone against her nightmares or the crushing weight of her responsibility, for they were nightmares and a weight he, too, had faced.
"You and Fankathara aren't that old yet, sir,"
she heard herself say equally softly, "and there's an extra command chair or two aboard Euphrates." She felt LeBlanc and McKenna staring at her in horror, and she knew they were right to feel it. But it made no difference as she watched Ivan the Terrible sit straighter in his chair. His dark, deep-set eyes brightened, cored with a fire that hadn't touched them in decades. But he shook his head.
"Prime Minister Quilvio would have me shot at dawn," he rumbled. Yet there was a yearning in his voice,
and Kathara laughed suddenly.
"Ah, Sharnook to the politicians! Or would you tell me that you have begun to worry about the reactions of Droshokol Mirzala Harlash at this late date?"
The Orion turned his slit-pupiled eyes to Murakuma.
"For myself, Admiral Murakuma, I will take one of those chairs you have so kindly offered. Warriors should die in battle, not in bed."
Murakuma smiled at him, but her attention was on Antonov, and the white-bearded fleet admiral glanced back at the hollow, then at her face, and shrugged.
"Very well, Admiral Murakuma. Make that two command chairs."
"Of course, sir."
Murakuma beamed while her staff looked on in stunned disbelief, then reached across the table to extend one slender hand to the military commander-in-chief of the Grand Alliance.
"Welcome along, sir,"
she said, and he laughed as his huge hand enveloped hers. Chapter 19.
I beg to report.
Vanessa Murakuma stood in her walker, seeming frailer than ever, with Ivan Antonov's massive presence on one side and Kathara Zartan's sable menace on the other, and watched as CIC's interpretation of the scouting pinnace's data coalesced on Cruchero's display. The pinnace losses had been even heavier than she'd feared, and she understood why when she saw what she'd sent them into. But she shoved that guilt into the back of her brain and bent to study the data.
"Well," she sighed, "it appears they do have normal OWPs to back those CAs."
"Yes, sir,"
Cruchero agreed, but his tone was quite different. He touched a function key, and his hawk-like face creased with predatory satisfaction as 18 super dreadnought-sized vessels flashed on the plot.
"They've got forts, sir, but they aren't very smart about how they emplace them. These aren't warships. Look at the energy readouts. They're construction ships."
"Construction ships?" Murakuma looked at the light codes glowing beside the flashing ships, and her eyes narrowed. "They're actually assembling forts right on top of a warp point?"
"Exactly, sir," the ops officer gloated. "It looks like they've got shields online, but not one of those forts even tried to pot a pin us. They would have if their point defense was operable. And look here."
He entered another command, and a visual replaced the icon-studded schematic. One of the pinnaces had made a close pass on an OWP, and the fort was studded with leprous patches of naked girders. A clumsy construction ship hovered nearby, and the imagery had actually caught its tractors transferring a capital missile launcher from its own holds to the base for installation, and Vanessa Murakuma bared her teeth in a smile her Orion allies would have understood perfectly.
"By God, we caught them with their pants down," she murmured. "And thank God we did, if they'd had time to get those things online."
She felt Antonov's presence, yet he'd made it clear this was her show. No doubt he would offer advice if she asked for it, but he had no intention of second-guessing her decisions, and she was grateful. She stood for a moment, thinking hard, then nodded sharply.
"All right, we'll go with Navarino 6. Our SBM Hawks will take the cruisers and the forts, if their point defense isn't up. We shouldn't need many to take them out. And TF-53 will hold its pods in reserve. The construction ships can't be heavily armed, so we'll take them out with shipboard weapons. But be sure they're designated as primary targets. I don't want any of them getting away in the confusion."
"Yes, sir. And their main force?"
"Ignore them. They're too far out for clean kills, and they might decide not to chase us if they have cripples."
"Yes, sir."
"Set up quickly, Ernesto," she told him, squeezing his shoulder to emphasize her urgency. "They know we're coming." The fleet raced to readiness as the last pinnace vanished back into the warp point. The enemy had chosen a bad moment. Even a few more days would have seen enough fortresses online to stop him. As it was, his missile pods could sweep them all away. The construction ships turned about, fleeing at their best, lumbering speed, and the massed super dreadnoughts of the picket force gathered their escorts close. They turned towards the warp point, but it was no part of their plan to enter the radius of the enemy's pods. Had the forts been ready, they might have been able to kill enough pods before they could fire. As it was, they could but wait to strike the enemy when he presented himself, and at least they were present in overwhelming strength.
"Execute!" Ernesto Cruchero snapped, and the TFN's SBM Hawks slammed through the warp point, locked their targeting systems, and fired.
The forts couldn't maneuver at all, and the slow-footed heavy cruisers were almost equally immobile. Point defense did its best, but only 13 of the cruisers escaped destruction, and losses were even heavier among the fortresses. Demosthenes Waldeck's TF-51 crashed through the warp point on the pod's heels, led by 20 Terran super dreadnoughts. The bugs had seeded their minefields with laser buoys, but they had fewer of them than a Terran admiral would have employed, and none at all of the far more lethal primary buoys. Unfortunately, Cruchero had been wrong about the OWPs, or, more precisely, he hadn't been entirely correct, for 5 were fully operational. They'd been mauled and battered, but they were as big as the TFN's OWP-6s. Half-destroyed as they were, each of them retained the missile power of a Matterhorn-class SD, and they poured close assault missiles into TF-51's teeth. For all intents and purposes, the CAMs were sprint-mode capital missiles, virtually impossible for point defense to engage, and the stress of transit had reduced their target system's efficiency as well. TFNS Fujisan, Gunbjorns, and Gran Paradiso, leading the Terran assault, blew apart under the pounding, but their consorts answered their deaths with massive, vengeful broadsides, and the forts were already badly damaged. That single agonizing salvo was all they got off, and the Terran super dreadnoughts turned their missile batteries on the minefield, even as their energy armaments massacred the frantically fleeing construction ships. AMBAMs blew their lanes through the mines, and the rest of TF-51 and the Terran and Ofiuki carriers of Vice Admiral Sakana's TF-52 formed up behind the battle line. The enemy had learned. He made no effort to lunge after the deep space picket through the gaps his missiles had blown in the mines. Instead, he waited, bringing forward all of his units and launching his small attack craft to cover them. The small fleet vessels fanned out, ignored by the hunter-killer satellites, but there were fewer of them this time. The last battle's ambush had killed many of the ships which carried them, and that was good. It meant they would be less able to swarm over the defending starships, and the enemy seemed to realize it as well, for they did not rush to the attack. Instead, they swept the space about the warp point, assuring themselves no additional units of the fleet lurked in cloak to ambush them once more. The fleet hesitated, but then its light-speed sensors began to report. They identified only 8 of the attack craft motherships, and the laser buoys must have done better than projected, for many enemy super-dreadnoughts streamed atmosphere in proof of heavy hull breaching. More than that, several had suffered drive damage as well. Their emissions were far weaker than usual, promising that they could be but little faster than the fleet, and the picket force accelerated towards the warp point once more.
"They're coming in,"
Commander Cruchero's voice was grimmer. He was the one who'd first assumed none of the OWPs were fully operational, and Murakuma heard his sense of guilt. But she'd leapt to the same conclusion, and she rested a slender hand on his shoulder once more.
"Good," she said. "It looks like your little brainstorm is working, Ernesto."
The ops officer looked up at her, then smiled almost shyly and bobbed his head in thanks for her reminder. And she turned her walker to cross to the command chair. She parked beside it, reaching out to rest her right hand on the helmet racked on its side, and watched the master plot. She and Cruchero had spent hours putting their surprise together, and she smiled thinly at the sensor readouts. Half her SDs had shut down anywhere from half to two-thirds of their shield generators and opened personnel locks to vent atmosphere. With their drive power reduced, they presented a chillingly realistic appearance of heavily damaged units, even to her, and her smile grew still thinner as she glanced at Sakana's carriers. All 9 of his Terran CVs had their ECM in deception mode, and they showed on her plot as battle cruisers, not carriers. 2 could play the decoy game, she thought viciously, and glanced at her comm officer.
Are the drones ready?
Yes, sir. All we need is the sensor data from plotting.
Good.
The AMBAMs had completed their mine-clearing duty, and Murakuma nodded to the comm screens linking her to Demosthenes' wall deck and Sakana's command decks.
You know the plan, gentlemen, she said. Now suck these bastards in and kick their asses.
The enemy moved at last, flowing through one of the cleared lanes towards the system's habitable planets. Clearly he intended a fight to the finish this time, for his wounded ships came with him rather than fleeing to safety, and that was good. Not only would it bring them out where the fleet could reach them, but it indicated he was weaker than anticipated. From his previous tactics, he would have sent them back, unless they were all he had and he needed them here.
"They're splitting up, sir," Cruchero reported. "Most are coming after us, but it looks like—" "Yes, sir. They're peeling off 12 SDs and their escorts to close the warp point."
"Good."
Murakuma glanced at Antonov, and the burly admiral nodded in grim approval. The main bug force retained a solid core of 96 super-dreadnoughts and 24 battle cruisers, but every little bit helped. Besides, it would make Anasa happy.
Composition of the detachment?
They look like acids, with carbines and cataphracts attached to cover them.
Makes sense, sir,
McKenna observed quietly.
The acids plasma guns to kill anything that tries to get past them either way, with the cruisers to cover them against fighter strikes. The main force probably figures it's got the point defense to handle fighters without them.
Then Admiral Sakana and Captain Oliveira will just have to show them the error of their ways.
Calm, update the alert drones and get them off. I want them out of here before the enemy's close enough to see them past our drive signatures.
Aye, aye, sir. Update downloaded and locked. Launching now.
2 courier drones separated from Euphrates. There was no need for more, with no one to shoot at them, as they vanished back through the warp point, and their emission signatures were lost in the background of 5th Fleet's drive fields.
Come to 115, Demosthenes.
5th Fleet altered heading, curving away on a wider arc, and the main bug force shifted its vector to cut a cord across it.
The maneuver let it simultaneously make up distance and get behind Murakuma's ships, edging between them and any retreat, while its detachment headed directly for the warp point as insurance. Thanks to her super dreadnought's drive damage, the bugs were actually a bit faster for a change. They were making the most of it, and she smiled thinly. The Alliance might still be unable to figure out what made the bastards tick, but it was nice to know they could be manipulated on a tactical level. The enemy continued on course. No doubt he would eventually realize he could not defeat the fleet's battle line with so few attack craft to support his wounded ships. When he did, he would turn to flee as he always did. But the blocking force would hold him in play, and the pursuit force would crush him against the warp point like a hammer. The blocking unit slid into position, and the pursuit force turned directly after him. "Launch the execute drones," Murakuma snapped, and hordes of courier drones, a torrent so vast the bugs had no hope of stopping it, streamed through the warp point. And even as they launched, Admiral Sakana's cloaked carriers dropped their deception. Hundreds of additional fighters, the Terrans configured for anti-shipping strikes and the Ophiuchi as a combat space patrol, streamed from their bays. And as they went out, the super dreadnoughts, which had been masquerading as cripples, switched shields and drives to full power and stopped venting air. TF-52's carriers accelerated away to keep clear of the battle, but TF-51's battle line turned back upon its enemies as the first jaw of Vanessa Murakuma's trap sprang, and then the second jaw struck. The sudden wave of courier drones completely surprised the blocking force. It opened fire as they flashed into their teeth, but only out of reflex, for the fleet had only begun to consider what their purpose might have been when it found out. These courier drones carried no message. Their appearance was their message, and 56th Fang of the Khan Anasa bared his fangs in predatory delight. He hadn't liked his secondary role, as first explained, but he was too experienced a warrior to argue. After all, the human's weapons and defensive technology were superior to his own, and system incompatibilities left his Orion and Gorm ships unable to integrate directly with their allies. And while he might dislike his own role, he admired the plan itself. It was more Orion than human in concept, for the TFN believed in simplicity. Small Claw LeBlanc had tried to explain the demon Murphy to Anasa over most of a bottle of bourbon, and the Fang had listened politely, but his own people preferred a more subtle approach, which emphasized carefully timed converging strokes. If pressed, he would admit the human insistence on minimizing complexity had its own virtues, but he was an Orion, not a human, and the more he saw of Vanessa Murakuma, the more he liked her. Now he yowled a terse order that sent 70 Orion SBM Hawk pods through the warp point, programmed with the targeting criteria Murakuma's first drones had provided, and 6 super dreadnoughts of the GSN led 14 battlecruisers through on their heels. The Guardian super dreadnoughts shuddered in agony as the pods spawned behind them. The enemy's missiles ignored the escort cruisers. Instead, they concentrated on the capital ships and missile CLs, and a wave of antimatter fury crashed over them. All the targeted cruisers died. The super dreadnoughts were savagely mauled, and even as the fleet reeled under the unexpected blow, fresh capital ships charged through the warp point at impossible speeds. Class for class, Gorm warships were the fastest any navy had ever built. The Gorm world was a harsh place, with brutally high gravity and background radiation levels higher than those of any other known sentient race's home planet. That environment had produced the Gormish philosophy of Synclomus, which enshrined the responsibility of every adult Gorm to protect all members of the Lomus, or household, from harm as his primary and overriding duty. But it had also produced a species which was incredibly tough. The Gorm were not only physically strong, with the blinding reaction speed their gravity well imposed, they also had a radiation tolerance no other species could match, and their starships took advantage of that tolerance. The fundamental technology of the enhanced drive system was common knowledge, but few navies were willing to pay the price the tuners imposed. It was nice to be able to build a super dreadnought as fast as anyone else's battlecruisers, yet the torrents of radiation the tuners produced were too much to expose one's personnel to.
Unless, of course, those personnel were Gorm, who could endure far higher radiation levels than anyone else. GSNS Hazak led her consorts through the warp point at a speed which would have had any Terran crew vomiting on the deck plates, and her capital missile launchers spat cams as she came. Only 7 acids had survived the SBM Hawk bombardment, and their battered defenses were no match for the massive fire of their undamaged foes. Only Nirtanahar, the 3rd ship in Force Leader Darnash's battle line, took any hits in return, and her heavy shields shrugged the pair of missiles aside almost contemptuously. None of the carbines had survived, and the cataphracts were suddenly helpless. They were minesweepers and anti-missile ships, fearful opponents for any fighter, but without a single weapon capable of damaging a starship. They turned on their foes, trying to ram, but the Gorm and their escorting Orion battlecruisers were too maneuverable. They evaded the kamikaze attacks, pouring energy fire into the cruisers while they dodged, and within 4 minutes, every unit of the blocking force had been destroyed without the loss of a single Allied unit. It was a trap. The blocking force was gone, and even as it died, torrents of small attack craft streaked from the battle cruisers accompanying the enemy's crippled battle line, even as still more carrier starships emerged from the warp point behind the impossibly fast super dreadnoughts. The fleet came to an abrupt halt, and then, for the first time since the war had begun, it turned to flee. It had no option, for it could neither overtake its foes unless the enemy chose to be overtaken, nor stand off such massive waves of attack craft. Its starships launched antimatter-loaded cutters in efforts to divert the attack craft, but this time the enemy refused to be diverted. Only a few attack craft swerved aside, engaging the cutters with lethal efficiency. The others bored straight in, and waves of additional craft came howling up from the warp point in support. Vanessa Murakumo watched with eyes of ice-cored jade as her fighters smashed into the bugs. Dozens of them died, but they rammed their attack home, and the first strike was decisive. The Ophiuchi Combat Space Patrol swarmed over the kamikaze small craft, piloted by the finest dogfighters in space, and the Terran and Orion pilots sent a tsunami of Frams into the super dreadnoughts. They didn't attempt to kill their targets. Instead, they concentrated on battering down the shields and armor of the Archer-class missile ships, pounding each ship just hard enough to be certain they'd destroyed its fragile first-generation data link. They reduced the bug's entire missile component to individual units, incapable of synchronizing their fire, and then they broke off, their losses incredibly light compared to earlier engagements, while Waldeck's battle line closed in from one side and Force Leader Darnash swept in from the other. It wasn't totally one-sided. A few bug missiles were bound to get through, despite the Archers' catastrophic damage, and they ignored the fire pouring in on them to concentrate everything they had on 1 or 2 Allied ships at a time. Yet they were doomed. Waldeck and Darnash had an overwhelming advantage, and they used it ruthlessly. They smashed the Archers into wreckage, then pulled back beyond standard missile range, pounding the shorter-range survivors with utter impunity, and the bugs broke. Enveloped by faster, longer-ranged enemies in deep space, they scattered in a desperate effort to save at least a few ships by forcing the Allied capital ships to choose which ones they would pursue and kill. But that was what Sakana and Anasa had been waiting for, and their rearmed, reorganized squadrons swept down on the bugs as they fell out of mutual support range. Entire strike groups drove in on single, isolated super dreadnoughts, taking their losses from the close-in defenses to streak in and blow them out of space. Once the bugs broke, it was one-sided, a massacre, and Vanessa Murakumo watched with cold, hating eyes as one by one the bug leviathans died under the stings of her deadly swarms of wasps. It took less than 2 hours, and when those 2 hours ended, not a single enemy starship survived in the entire Justin system. All right, Demosthenes, she said then. Secure the K-45 warp point. You can send a few pinnaces through for a look, but don't take any chances.
Yes, sir.
The embers of battle still smoked in Waldeck's eyes, but he nodded soberly. Calm, Murakumo looked over her shoulder. Inform General Mondesi that he can proceed against the planets. Aye, aye, sir. The communications officer dispatched another courier drone to the transports in Sarasota, and Murakama's walker whined softly as she turned to face Ivan Antonov.
Sir, she said very quietly and formally, I beg to report that Fifth Fleet has regained control of the Justin system.
Chapter 20. Ashes of Victory. It's confirmed, sir. They never even landed on Clements.
I'll be damned.
Major General Raphael Mondesi, TFMC, Lion of Terra, Grand Solar Cross, shook his head. He'd never believed, never let himself believe, Admiral Murakuma's order to go bush would work, but the entire population of Justin B. had eluded the bugs.
It wouldn't have worked against humans, he thought. We're too damned curious. Someone would have landed, if only to see what was there. But the bugs didn't. Interesting, and possibly useful. If they're that much less curious than we are, we may just be able to use it against them.
He nodded, but he had little time to ponder the thought, for his assault force was closing on the planets of Justin A. After lengthy discussion, he and Least Claw Tharan, Fang Anasa's senior marine, had concluded they had no choice but to hit Justin and Harrison in succession. Neither liked it, and their troops were going to be enormously outnumbered anyway, however they operated, but this time Mondesi had the assets to equalize the odds. His transport's assault shuttles would make mincemeat out of any bug helicopter foolish enough to contest the air, and their escorting starships would be available for fire support. They could lay conventional precision-guided munitions in right on his own positions at need, and the fleet base had diverted enough of its capacity to build sufficient support weapons to arm the Allied contingents with Terran mortars, heavy grenade launchers, and HVM. He turned to the hollow fleet had already generated from radar and optical mapping, and his eyes were bleak. That detailed space-eye look at the terrain was invaluable, but it also revealed what had happened to the planets he'd tried to defend. What had been cities were wastelands churned by high explosives, incendiaries, even nukes. The humans of Justin and Harrison had known what would happen to them, and those who'd been unable to make it to the refugee camps had stood and fought with the ferocity of despair. Now their hopeless fight had ground to its ghastly conclusion, and the shattered ruins told him what he was going to find. He glared at the glass-floored crater which had once been Justin's capital, and hate boiled at his core like lye. This deliberate mass slaughter of non-combatants said there not only would not, but could not be any question of quarter or negotiated peace. As Admiral Murakama had said so many months before, when this war ended, there would be only the victors and the dead. And so Raphael Mondesi embraced his hatred. For if a species must die, it would not be his. The Terran transport slid into orbit, and grim battalions from three different races filed into their assault shuttles. The handful of marines aboard the Gorm ships wouldn't be used. They lacked powered armor, and the planet would have been a hostile environment for them. But the Ophiuchi and Orions had provided the equivalent of 2.5 more brigades of raiders. The Tabby's armor wasn't quite as good as the Federation's, but the Ophiuchi's was actually better. Even so, Mondesi was going to have to use a lot of people in regular battle dress. That was a losing proposition against bugs, but he had a plan to reduce the odds, and as part of that plan, he'd picked spots for his spaceheads just beyond weapons range of the bugs' main concentration. Now the shuttles swooped into atmosphere to land their troops, and heavy lift shuttles brought in Terran assault skimmers, artillery, and air defense batteries manned by drafted Navy technicians. And even as the troops dug in, the assault shuttles howled back aloft. Half were tasked to bring in the follow-up waves, but the other half were armed with external ordnance to provide air support. In any peacetime exercise this size, Mondesi reflected, there would have been massive confusion, even without the need to cooperate with non-human allies. There'd simply been too little planning time for any other outcome. But there was very little muddle now, and draconian orders sorted out any that did arise ruthlessly. In less than 3 hours, each of his divisions had a 2-brigade force down and dug in, ready for any bug counterattack. Not only ready, but praying for it.
This time they had the firepower, and every bug that died discovering that fact would be one less they'd have to hunt down later.
"What's the latest?" the general growled, settling into the padded chair aboard his Cobra Divisional Command Vehicle.